Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, as I watched the thousands of protesters gather here in D.C. and around the country last weekend, I wanted to know what it could mean for action at the federal level. So I asked Chris Van Hollen, Democratic senator from Maryland, for his thoughts.
The fact that students are now so engaged in this effort is going to make a defining difference over the coming years. And that is a major new element in this fight.
Then, a memoir of growing up in an isolated and at times abusive family in the mountains of Idaho. I talked with author Tara Westover about how an education helped her understand her complicated childhood.
It took me a long time to realize there are limits to the obligations that you owe to your family, and that sometimes those obligations to your family, they can be in real conflict with what you owe to yourself, and that there are times where you are allowed to choose you. You're allowed to choose yourself.
First, here's Senator Chris Van Hollen.
Diane, it's Chris. How are you?
I am just fine, Senator. So great to have you with us.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Earlier this week, you tweeted that families in Baltimore and across the country deal with gun violence every single day, a fact we can never forget. The fight for gun safety is not just about school shootings and mass shootings, but also about the daily toll of violence. We must do better. So here's the question. What does doing better mean to you?
It means saving lives. It means adopting common sense gun safety measures that will save lives, both by stopping many of these massacres, like school shootings or what we saw in Las Vegas, but also reducing the daily toll of gun violence on our streets. The very day of the March for Our Lives in Washington, you had three young people who were shot in Baltimore City. And so we need to address gun safety in a comprehensive manner. And that means adopting a number of measures that will reduce the death toll. And we often hear from opponents of gun safety that these measures won't end all gun violence. And that's true. We're not going to end all gun violence, but we can save lots of lives. And in fact, when you know there's a way to save lives and you don't take action, you're complicit in that loss of life. And so Congress needs to act, and it needs to act now.
More than a million people around the country actively participated in marches last weekend. We've had marches before. Is it different this time?
Yes, I think it is different for a number of reasons. And first, we've already seen measures that have been taken in the private sector by companies that want to be seen as responsible actors and companies that want to disassociate themselves with the NRA and the gun lobby. So, for example, many of the airlines ended their partnership relations with the NRA. You saw Dick's Sporting Goods Store, Walmart, others put in place new limitations. So the fact that you saw that happening out in the private sector was clearly a signal of the change in public opinion. In terms of congressional action, we need to keep the pressure on because the opponents of gun safety are counting on people going home after the march. And we need to make sure that we stay in this fight week in and week out, and also at election time. And I do think the student movement, the fact that students are now so engaged in this effort, is going to make a defining difference over the coming years. And that is a major new element in this fight.
Did you participate in the march in D.C.?
Yes, I did. I was proud to march with students from the March for Our Lives. In fact, we had a Maryland rally, many of the Maryland marchers gathering up on Capitol Hill before the march and pledging that the march really is just the first step and making it very clear that this has to be more than the moment of the march. This has to be a sustained movement going forward and focusing on elections, because when it comes to, you know, passing gun safety laws on Capitol Hill, you need the votes. If you want to get the policy right, you've got to get the politics right, and that means making this an issue in some of the elections and winning.
So lots of folks heard that you were going to be on the program, and they decided to tweet us with their questions. The first one that came in, do you support repealing the Second Amendment?
I do not support that. I think we should be focused on common sense measures within the parameters of the Second Amendment. So far, the courts, for the most part, have supported a common sense gun safety regulation. For example, in my state of Maryland, we have passed a law requiring that you get a license to purchase a handgun, just like you need a license to drive an automobile. That has not been challenged, and it has been found by everyone who's looked at it to be perfectly consistent with the Second Amendment. State of Maryland has also passed a ban on these military-style assault rifles, and the Fourth Circuit found that was also consistent with the Second Amendment, and it was not taken up by the Supreme Court. The Fourth Circuit's decision was not reviewed or overturned. So I believe that these common sense measures that we're talking about here on Capitol Hill are consistent with the Second Amendment, and they will save lives, and that should be our focus.
Well, the question becomes how much support there is on Capitol Hill for banning these assault rifles.
Well, on that particular issue, it's going to take efforts at the ballot box to get more votes in the United States House and Senate. I do believe that if there's a major focus, that we can make progress on the universal background check legislation, because it makes no sense to have a system where you go to a licensed gun dealer and you go through the National Instant Background Check system, but you go down the street to a gun show and you can buy anything you want without that kind of a background check. Now, a number of years ago, we had a vote on that. It was over 50 voted for it, but we did not reach the threshold of 60. If President Trump would do what he said he would do when the cameras were, running over at the White House, we would be able to get additional votes. I mean, you remember, Diane, that he said he was in favor of the universal gun check legislation.
Yep.
And in fact, he then said, you know, looking around the table, who's afraid of the NRA? And then the next night, he invites the NRA over for dinner, and the NRA issues a press statement saying, you know, President Trump doesn't want gun control. And we found out who's afraid of the NRA, Donald Trump, because if he were serious about what he said when the cameras were blaring, then we would have a chance of picking up some of the votes, at least on the universal background check legislation. But it was obviously a cynical move, saying one thing's before the camera, which he knew the American people wanted to hear, and then having dinner with the NRA behind closed doors. But we need to build the political pressure. The fact that the president said what he said with the cameras on shows that he knows where the American public is on this.
So do you think that these million marchers, many, many young people, can make any kind of a difference? Or is it simply that because Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, the White House, and apparently the NRA controls most of them, that we're not going anywhere?
Well, I think we are going to move forward. I think it's going to be a, you know, not just a day-to-day commitment. It's got to be months and years. And I'll give you a very good example of what could change the political psychology on this issue. If you look at Senate races and House races around the country, where the difference between the candidates on gun safety is a defining issue, those are the opportunities for students and others to really organize and make a difference. And there are two U.S. Senate races in 2018 that fit that description. One is in Florida, where the current governor of Florida, Rick Scott, has an A-plus rating from the NRA. He had been scheduled to give a big national speech before the NRA, before the tragedy in Parkland. And he has been trying to sort of, you know, change his spots when it comes to the gun safety issues. But he has an A-plus rating from the NRA. His opponent is the incumbent senator, Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson favors these common sense gun safety measures that we're talking about. Bill Nelson favors the universal background check. He favors a ban on semi-automatic assault rifles. So there's a state where you could send a very strong political signal that the public stands for common sense gun safety. The other is the state of Nevada. The incumbent senator, Dean Heller, has an A-plus rating from the NRA. We, of course, saw the terrible massacre in Las Vegas there, and yet he has refused to support any of these simple measures. His opponent, his challenger, is Jackie Rosen. She's currently a member of the House of Representatives. She supports these common sense gun safety measures. Hmm. So Nevada and Florida are two states where you have candidates on opposing sides of this simple question, and if people spend time, energy, and effort in those states, it would make a very big political statement to the Congress about how the public views this issue and how they act on this issue.
And back to your own role, Senator Van Hollen, here is a tweet from Robin. What role will you play differently now that you had this humongous wave of support to be sure the loophole for background checks closes?
Well, that's we're going to continue to fight this issue for the in this year in the United States Senate, really you know, demanding a vote on this issue, and going to keep pushing. And this is where, you know, we need reinforcements, and this is where we do need to shame President Trump, although I have to say he seems to be immune to shaming. But the reality is when he brought the cameras in, he knew where the public stood on this issue. So in the next couple, you know, months, if we're going to get that those Republican votes before the election, we're going to need Trump to weigh in. But beyond that, what I'm doing is helping to focus our resources and efforts on these two Senate races that I talked about. And young people can make a huge difference in the outcome of these races. In some ways, when it comes to voting in midterms, the young vote is the sleeping giant. And if it wakes up and gets out there and votes, it can make a dramatic difference, because young people, and by young people I mean between the ages of 18 and 29, they turn out and vote at about 50% in presidential elections. In other words, 50% of eligible young voters vote in presidential elections. But that drops dramatically at midterm elections, down to about 25%. It's by far the biggest drop-off in voter participation between presidential elections and midterms has been among young voters. So if they get out and vote in numbers like they do in the presidential elections, they can make a difference in Florida. They can make a difference in Nevada. And we're working with our colleagues to try to make that happen.
Here is a tweet from Aaliyah, who says, will you support H.R. 5087 assault weapons ban of 2018 or a similar measure in the Senate?
Yes, I do support that legislation. These weapons of war have no place in our streets, in our schools. And as we know, Congress enacted an assault weapons ban back in the 1990s, but it expired on its own terms at sunset after 10 years. We need to put in place the assault weapons ban and get these weapons of war off our streets. The state of Maryland, as I said, has a law, and it was upheld by the Fourth Circuit, a ban on semi-automatic military rifles. We should do that as a country as well. So, yes, I support that.
How much, realistically, do you believe gun control will be an issue in the 2018 midterms?
Well, we need to make it an issue. And we saw, millions of people turn out around the country for the March for Our Lives. We've seen students who are very energized and engaged on this issue. And so we need to make this as much of a voting issue as the NRA tries to make this voting issue the other way by opposing those who support these common sense life-saving measures. So that's really up to all of us. It's up to the voters and everybody who came to the march. We need to make sure that we don't go away after the march, but that we stick with this and fight through these elections and make this an important ballot box issue in these key races where there's a difference between the candidates on this important question.
I want to turn briefly to another issue, and that is the ouster of David Shokin as Veterans Affairs Secretary, and now the president has tapped his personal physician, Ronnie Jackson, to run this humongous 360,000-person agency with a budget of $186 billion. He has absolutely no management background. What's your perspective?
Well, I am very nervous about the signal that this sends. Look, I had concerns with some of the problems that arose under Secretary Shulkin's leadership, but it was very clear that he had the interests of veterans at heart.
And you're talking about his travel and the fact he took his wife with him on the trip and then repaid the government for those expenses.
Yes, I think that showed very bad judgment, the fact that that happened. I've also been concerned with some of the unacceptable situations at some of the veterans hospitals around the country, including the one that serves the D.C. Region. I've been very outspoken about the problems there. But what really worries me about the new appointment is not only the lack of management, but whether this is sending a signal that the Trump administration wants to privatize the VA. And this is a concern that the veterans organizations have, because the Koch brothers and other groups like them have been pushing for years to privatize the entire VA system. Right now, we have a system that does allow veterans to choose to go to non-VA private hospitals for their care, and that's appropriate. I mean, we wanted to make sure they had that choice. But we do not want to eliminate the choice of VA hospitals, and that's what would happen if you do 100% privatization. And Secretary Shulkin had been very outspoken on this issue. So there's a lot of nervousness that his replacement does not share his views on that. And in fact, he wrote about that today, the outgoing secretary did.
What about all the other shakeups in this administration coming now? Do they make you nervous?
Well, two things make me nervous. One is the total chaos in this administration, because you want to have some kind of steady management at the White House, regardless of the ideological views of a particular White House because you especially want our foreign adversaries to, you know, believe that the White House is being managed in a professional, grown-up manner. Beyond the pure chaos, I'm very worried, Diane, about some of the appointments that are being made, most especially with respect to John Bolton. Having him be the person who whispers in the president's ear every morning, every day on vital national security issues gives me great, great concern.
What about him gives you great concern?
Well, he has a record of warmongering. He's got a record of being trigger happy, shooting first, asking questions later. He was one of the prime cheerleaders of the war in Iraq. And unlike others who supported that war and then, you know, expressed their reservations about what had happened, he has never sort of expressed reservations about his role in that, which makes me worried.
Do you think he could actually take us to war in North Korea? He has made so many statements about regime takeover and that kind of thing. Does that worry you?
Well, it worries me in North Korea. It also worries me in Iran. He has talked in the past of bombing Iran, and one of the big decisions coming up for this administration is whether to continue with the Iran nuclear agreement, which, of course, is the agreement that has prevented Iran from moving forward to obtain a nuclear weapon. And if the administration scraps that agreement and gets rid of the agreement, it will be a green light to Iran to move forward with the nuclear program. And, you know, then the question is, okay, what do you do? And the response John Bolton's given in the past is, well, you know, you attack them, and the whole reason to have an agreement is to prevent them from doing that and getting ourselves in that box.
Does the president need approval from Congress to move forward in either of those situations?
I would argue strongly yes. Taking those actions, a first strike, a first military strike, whether it's on Iran or North Korea, is clearly an act of war. You know, the president can, of course, take action in defense and retaliation for an attack by any country. And if an attack is absolutely imminent from a country, the president has the ability to initiate action. But to simply, you know, wake up and say, okay, I'm going to attack a country because down the road they may pose a risk is something that the presidents cannot do on their own authority. That would require an act of Congress. Now, the big question, of course, is whether or not the president will adhere to the Constitution. And that's where it's really important that we have Republican senators and Republican members of the House making it clear that as a separate branch of government with the authority under the Constitution to declare war, Congress has to be a part of that decision.
You've got an awful lot on your plate, Senator Van Hollen. I wish you all success.
Thank you, Diane, and it's good to be with you today.
Thank you so much. Now a quick break.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily. Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Tara Westover is the author of the new memoir titled Educated. It is a shockingly profound memoir, and I was truly moved as I read it. She joined me in the studio. Tara, it's so good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You begin your book with a description of your home in the mountains. Give us an idea of what that was and how you lived.
So I was raised, the youngest of seven children, on this really beautiful mountain in southern Idaho. And, you know, we had a farm that belonged to my grandfather, and we had a junkyard full of crumpled up cars that belonged to my father. And my mother was a midwife and an herbalist, and when I was a child, we spent a lot of hours walking on the mountain gathering mullein flowers and yarrow leaves and other herbs that she could stew into tinctures or other remedies. And in a lot of ways, it was a really beautiful childhood. And of course, it was the only life I had ever known. So to me, it seemed completely normal. And it wasn't until I got much older that I realized it wasn't completely normal. And there were a lot of aspects of it that were pretty unusual.
What kind of education did you have?
So my father was something of a charismatic radical. And what that meant for us was, I mean, he was opposed to a lot of the institutions that most people take for granted. Public education was one of them, but he was also opposed to doctors and hospitals and really anything to do with the government. And so I was never put in school, and we were never taken to the doctor, not when we were ill, not when we were injured. My mother would treat it with herbalism. And I actually didn't even have a birth certificate until I was nine, which, because I didn't have school records or medical records, meant that according to the state of Idaho, I just didn't exist.
And what did that mean to you?
It didn't mean much to me. Again, it seemed normal to me. I remember when my mother tried to get my birth certificate finally when I was nine, and she had a lot of trouble doing that because they couldn't establish my birth date. They couldn't remember for sure when it was. There was conflicting accounts of it, different memories of it. And then, of course, they had no way to prove that I'd been born at all. So I remember she was on the phone a lot with these people. And we'd only recently gotten the telephone. A lot of years we didn't have the telephone. And everyone seemed to find it so unusual. I understood that everyone was finding it strange that they didn't know my birthday, that I didn't have a birth certificate. But for me, I found them finding it strange, because it had just seemed normal to me. I had a birthday, like everybody else. I just celebrated it on a different day every year. I just picked a day, whatever day didn't fall on Sunday, because I didn't want to have my birthday in church.
So you did not go to school at all?
No. The first time I set foot in a classroom, I was 17.
And what did you know when you set foot in that classroom?
Well, I had an older brother when I was 16 who told me I should try to go to college. He had taught himself enough math, enough grammar, enough kind of everything to pass the ACT and go to college. So then he came back and told me to do the same thing when I was 16.
He came back after he had been to college.
Yeah, so he was finishing his degree, and my parents had gotten more radical as they got older. So when he was younger, he was quite a lot older than me, my brother. When he'd been young, he'd been allowed to go to a few years of school. He'd even been allowed, I think, to go to the eighth or ninth grade. And then he was pulled out, and that's when most of my siblings were pulled out. So he had a little bit of a foundation of education, enough that he was able to teach himself and then go to university. But I had never been in a classroom at all, so my situation was quite different. But he did come back and say, look, you can do this. It's one exam. Just learn some algebra, learn a little bit of grammar, and do well enough on this test, and you can go to university. So
help you do that?
He did try to. I mean, he was living quite far away at the time. So he did meet up with me for one evening to try to teach me trigonometry, which I was just not able to teach myself. He was able to teach himself trigonometry, but I think it was hard for him. He told me years later, after getting he had a PhD in mechanical engineering from Purdue, and he told me that teaching himself trigonometry was the hardest thing he'd ever done in his life. And I just wasn't able to do it. So I got to a point where I had to take this exam. And I was 16, and I'd never had anyone teach me math, and I went and visited him, and he spent an evening trying to explain sine, cosine, and tangent to me well enough that I could just survive the ACT. And that was always the goal, just get through this one exam, which I didn't do brilliantly on it, but I did well enough to get into the university. But that itself was a problem, because I didn't have an education. I just had one test that I'd gotten through.
That was Brigham Young University.
Yeah, it was Brigham Young University, which is probably one of the only universities in the United States that will admit you without a high school diploma or an equivalent, because I didn't have one and I was too young to take the GED.
I want to go back for a moment to your father. He really expected the world to end at Y2K.
He expected the world to end a lot, I would say. Y2K is kind of the example that I go into the most depth in the book because it's what I remember really vividly. But my dad had a really strong conviction that the end was coming at any time. And it would inevitably, any sign that was happening, maybe that there would be a particularly bright full moon, or maybe that there was going to be some kind of eclipse event that he would hear about, anything like that, he would say, well, this is when the world, every year really, it was another date that he would pick. And as far as I know, he's still doing that. So Y2K certainly was something that he picked up on and decided, well, yes, this will be the end of the world.
Do you attribute much of his behavior, no doctors, no schooling, that sort of thing, to the fact that he disliked, distrusted, disbelieved everything that was in the world?
I don't know exactly where his beliefs came from. I think, you know, when I was a kid, I just thought that he was right because I didn't go to school and I didn't have access to other perspectives. So he just seemed to me like this prophetic figure. And the world, I assumed, was exactly the way he described it. And even when I left and went to college, I still very much subscribed to his worldview. And I thought everyone else was wrong and we were right. And so when I went to college, I didn't want to work in my dad's scrapyard anymore. It was a very dangerous place to work. And Tyler, my older brother, was telling me I should try college. But I was still very ideologically bound to my father, and I still saw the world the way that he did. And it was a long, slow process. One of the things that I think first made me question my dad's beliefs, my father's beliefs, was just a psychology 101 course I took. And they were talking about the symptoms of mood disorders, of bipolar, of schizophrenia, paranoia disorders. And as a child, I had never understood anything about mental illness. I thought that you could be sane or you could be insane. And I didn't really understand that you could be a very functional human being and something could still be wrong. And I'm not a medical professional, so I have no idea if that is what's wrong with my dad. But it did give me a way to understand my childhood that did start to make sense to me, just a paranoia and a way of seeing the world that I could then begin to understand my upbringing and why we had lived the way that we lived.
You mentioned the scrapyard. Talk about what happened in that scrapyard to you.
The scrapyard is a hard thing to talk about because my dad did not have that bone in his head that tells people when something they're doing is dangerous, when it's risky. I think, again, part of the way his mind worked, he didn't believe in safety equipment, and he did not believe in just kind of basic safety measures. And so really frequently he would ask you to do something or set things up in such a way that someone was not only could get hurt but was very likely to get hurt. And
give me an example.
I mean, one of the things that happened to me, there was a big bucket of scrap, the big bin of scrap that had to be dumped into an even larger trailer, a semi-truck trailer load of scrap. And usually what you do is you get a forklift with an extendable boom and you pick it up and you dump it. And then afterwards, someone will crawl in and kind of settle the scrap so that more will fit in. And my dad, because he was always in a hurry and he had just this strange way of thinking where he didn't realize things could go wrong. I think he really believed that God would not allow anything bad to happen to anyone. So you could just kind of do what you wanted and God would kind of make it all right. He decided that the most time effective thing to do would be to have me climb into the bin and then he would move it over and get ready to dump it. But then give me a few seconds to kind of climb out into the bin and then move to the side, maybe climb onto the cab to safety. And then he would dump it and I would already be there to settle it. So he wouldn't have to take a second trip to run me into this enormous trailer. But what happened is while he was moving the bin and I was inside it, a piece of scrap metal shifted and it just impaled my leg. It went straight into my leg and I couldn't move, so I couldn't climb out of the bin. And I couldn't shout to him because it was a massive, you know, forklift it was a JCB with an extendable boom, a really loud diesel engine. He couldn't hear me shouting at him. So then he raised the bin and dumped it, and I was still inside it. And I was very lucky because if I'd gone down the front, I would have effectively gone through. It would have been like going through a meat grinder. But what happened instead is I was able to throw myself over the side of the bin. And so I just fell to the ground. It was probably 16, 18 feet. And I was okay. I mean, I hit the side of the trailer and I was pretty banged up. And I had obviously a big gash in my leg, but I was all right. But the thing is, at the time, I did not have the information to understand what was happening to me. So I knew that my dad loved me and I knew that he valued my safety. And so as a child, you know, I think I was only about 10, 12 years old at the time. I didn't have a way to understand what was happening that didn't just involve either blaming myself, thinking, well, this was an easy thing he asked me to do, why couldn't I do it? Or thinking, well, my father doesn't care about me, my father doesn't love me. And I think what was an important piece of information for me that I didn't get until later in my life was this concept of mental illness. That I really believe that my father was unable to evaluate risk or even understand that someone was hurt after it had happened. And it was something as a child I just didn't know. I did not understand that my father could love me, could value my safety, but could not be mentally able to keep me safe. It just wasn't information that I had.
How did your leg heal?
It healed eventually. It took quite a long time. I mean, I still do have a big scar by my knee, about 5 inches.
No stitches.
No, because my
family medical treatment.
No, because my family doesn't believe in medical treatment. So my mother put some herbs on it and gave me some tinctures to take, and that was all the treatment that was done for it. And again, I think people will hear that and want to think that my dad just didn't care about us. But I do think that's an oversimplification because, for one thing, the worst injury that happened to anybody in my family in the junkyard happened to my dad because he was standing next to a car when the car exploded. And it exploded because he hadn't taken proper safety precautions. He had not drained the fuel tank before lighting a torch to remove the tank. And anyone would have done that. And he just didn't because he didn't think he needed to. And he was burned terribly. And even in that situation, my parents did not take him to the hospital. They treated it at home. And he nearly died. And it was a recovery that took months of terrible pain. And I tell that story because, to me, it proves the sincerity of his beliefs. That's not to say that it was all right what he was doing, because I don't think it was. But I think it proves, you know, it's not that he didn't take us to the doctor because he didn't care about us. And it's not that he was giving himself medical care and denying it to us. He really believed that the doctors were going to harm us in some way and that the best place for us was at home. And he believed that about himself as well.
And even where your tonsils were concerned.
Yeah, I got tonsillitis when I was about 14. And my dad told me that the sun was the most powerful natural healer, that nobody knew about this secret of how powerful the sun was. So he had me stand outside every morning for, I think he wanted me to do it for an hour, but I'm not sure I ever managed a whole hour. And just open my mouth and let the sun shine on my tonsils, which in Idaho in January outside is probably not where you should go if you have tonsillitis. Also, you get a terrible jaw ache, I can tell you. I did this for about a month and it did not help.
So what happened to your tonsils?
I got seriously sick. And, you know, I was just sick for about, I don't know, it seems like about a year.
Tara, I mean, the stories you tell, I understand why a child would simply accept and attribute to your father's wisdom. Where was your mother in all of this?
My mother is this incredibly talented, incredibly capable woman who has a competency level that is almost hard to describe, but she is also incredibly passive. And she will have her own views of things. When my father, you know, he'll come up with these ideas, like he once decided from reading Isaiah that milk was evil and honey was good. There's a passage in Isaiah about the Christ child being given milk and honey, that he may know to choose the evil and leave the good. And my dad took that very literally and decided it meant milk was bad and honey was good. And for a while, I remember my mother being very skeptical of that and kind of thinking that my dad would, that it would pass. And then she tends to get on board. That actually did pass eventually. But my mother, she would convert to these things eventually if he didn't let them go. And I think the doctors, it was one of those things that when it started, my mother was the moderate voice. And he would say these things about doctors. And then my mother would kind of quietly dissent but never confront him about it until eventually she would just start to echo him.
Tell me what you believe your father was protecting you from and or preparing you for.
I think he thought that the world had been corrupted by something like the Illuminati, the New World Order. I think he was also, some of it was a very spiritual anxiety that he had, that we would get corrupted by worldly forces. So it had a kind of religious extremist element to it. I'm always careful when I talk about that element because it's long been my view that whatever mental disorder my dad had caused the religious extremism and not the other way around. So I am always trying to get away from talking about this story as a story about religious extremism, because especially about Mormonism, because yes, we were Mormon and we grew up in a Mormon community, but everyone else in my Mormon town went to the doctor, they had birth certificates, they went to school. It doesn't seem to me to be factually accurate to say this is about Mormonism. I think it's about one person's kind of mind and the way that the world was very distorted by the time it got to him. You know, once it went through his mind, the world became a much more distorted place, and I think it's about that.
So how did he react when you did finally go to Brigham Young University? And how did you get there?
How I got there, I'm not sure. I don't know how I passed that test. I really don't. And I've talked to faculty at the university who said that based on the score I got without any supporting document, they really have no idea. They said, I've sat on the admissions committee, we would not have accepted you. I don't know how you got in. So I genuinely don't know the answer to that. But I did get in, and my dad was not happy. You know, he wanted me to, for one thing, he was very skeptical of universities. But he also especially was skeptical of me going. I was supposed to get married. I was supposed to have children. I was supposed to take over being a midwife and an herbalist for my mother. And so he was definitely against it. We had come to a kind of understanding because I had said I was going to go study music. And my father and I had both kind of come to a kind of truce around the idea that music was an all right or almost acceptable thing, that a woman could go study music. He would rather I had studied it at home, but at least it was music and not politics or something. He said that exact thing to me once, actually.
That music.
Yeah, well, if you have to go to university, at least you're studying music and not politics or history or something.
We haven't talked about your brother, whom you call Sean. Tell us about him.
So I would say it was a quality of my upbringing that everything had these kind of two sides. So the junkyard could be this exotic playground, but it could also be really dangerous and really frightening if you got hurt, especially if you couldn't get any kind of treatment. And my brother was exactly in this vein. He could be the most incredible, sensitive, kind, self-sacrificing person. There was a time when I was 16. He actually saved my life. We were riding horses together, and I was on a horse, and I just lost control of the animal. He went berserk, and the reins flew over his head, and my foot got caught in the stirrup, which, if you know much about horse riding, if you're on a horse and the horse has gone into a frenzy and your foot's caught in the stirrup, you're kind of done because you'll fall off, but you won't fall clean off. What'll happen is you'll be dragged, and your head will hit a rock, and you're done. And so I thought, that's it, I'm finished, because my brother was there, but he was behind me on a horse that had never been ridden before, not a single time. It was his first time with a person on its back. And I thought, there is no way that he will risk whipping this 1,200-pound thoroughbred that he was on into a fit in order to catch my horse, because he'll know. He'll never be able to calm that horse down again, not when it's never been ridden before. And he'll be really putting himself at risk if he does that. But that's exactly what he did, and he saved me, and at great risk to himself. So he was capable of these incredible acts of self-sacrifice and sensitivity, but he had another side to him where he had an incredible depth of self-loathing, I think, and that would come out in these very controlling and sometimes very violent ways where he would just need to demonstrate to you or to other people that he had this much power over you, that he had this much control. And he would do it over small things. He would say, "But you know, get me a glass of water," and then you would, and then he would say, "Oh no, go put ice in the water," and then you'd bring it back, and he would be angry and say, "What the hell is this ice doing in here? You know, I don't want this." And you could just he would do this for 10-15 minutes. You know, take it out, put it back in, take it out, put it back in. And when you got to the point when you were tired of the game and just wouldn't play anymore, he would become angry. He would become violent. Sometimes he would try to pretend like it was a game, and he would start laughing and act like you were just wrestling, but you weren't, because he would be choking you. Or often it would end with him grabbing me by my hair and hauling me down the hallway and shoving my head in a toilet. And he had a name for me, a word for me that he called me a lot, which was whore, which, because I was a teenager, really entered into the way that I thought about myself, the way that I felt about myself. And when I was 16, I wrote a journal entry about my brother that had this sentence in it that said, "It's strange how you give the people you love so much power over you." But of course, I mean, my brother Sean, he had more power over me than I could have even imagined. He had defined me to myself in a lot of ways. And there's not really a greater power, I think, than that.
Somehow you got a scholarship to Cambridge. How did that happen?
I had a professor. So my first semesters at BYU were pretty much unmitigated disasters, just one right after the other. I didn't know what I was doing. I raised my hand to one of my first lectures and asked what the Holocaust was, because I just hadn't heard of it. And, of course, everyone thought I was being anti-Semitic. They thought I was denying it. They heard it as, "What is this?" But I very much meant it as, "What? What is this?" And so I had just a really rough couple of semesters. But again, I'd been trapped in my father's worldview for so long that once I began to get access to different perspectives, it was completely addicting. And I started taking courses and everything, and I really had a real enthusiasm for it. So that by the time I graduated, I was doing pretty well. And one of my professors just decided to help me, basically, and got me onto the study abroad program at Cambridge. I applied for it and was rejected, actually. But he wrote them and said, "No, you have to take her," and they did. And while I was there, I met a professor at Cambridge, a very eminent scholar of the Holocaust, ironically, who again just decided to help me. And when I applied to Cambridge, he had read a lot of my work and wrote amazing references for me that enabled me to get the scholarship.
Where are you now in relation to how you live, how you compare and contrast how you lived before? And how does writing this book about your family make you feel about them?
Well, the story with my family was really bound up with the story of my education, because, and I say education, I mean that in the broadest sense, not just classrooms, but all the things that you read and learn and the people that you meet. You know, education in this really broad sense had a really big impact on the relationship I had with my family. And the reason it did that is because what my education gave me was independence of mind, and I hadn't had that before. I had been someone who's, you know, my ideas were my father's ideas, and there wasn't any difference between what he thought and what I thought. And that had made me really vulnerable. It had made me vulnerable to my brother. You know, when those incidents would happen with my brother, he would really quickly, after the fact, be able to reinterpret those experiences for me, to either downplay them or to even sometimes tell me that they hadn't happened at all. And I would go along with that because I was much more comfortable having other people tell me what had happened. And I think this is common for a lot of people that have these kind of relationships. I think all abuse, no matter what kind of abuse it is foremost an assault on the mind. Because if you're going to abuse someone, you have to invade their reality and you have to distort it. And I was vulnerable to that. But what happened as I became more educated in this broader sense, and maybe even in the narrow sense of just knowing things that my parents didn't know. There was a moment my senior year when my dad visited me and started in on this kind of anti-Semitic lecture where I realized, you know, he was quoting from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I knew the history of that text because I'd taken this whole course in Jewish history, and I knew that it had been discredited as a forgery. And I knew that that hadn't stopped Adolf Hitler from quoting it in Mein Kampf. And I knew that my father would have been horrified to be quoting Adolf Hitler. So it was kind of the first time in our relationship that was a reversal of the parent-child relationship.
So what did you say?
I didn't say much. There wasn't any point. I could tell there wasn't any point. But I sat there in the dinner, and I, more importantly, in my journal later, I wrote to myself, this is wrong. You know, his version of reality, of history, is incorrect. And I think just that ability to have my own opinions when my parents were saying something else was not something I'd had before. And I think having my own understanding of the past, it would bleed over so that I would develop my own understanding of the present. And it would get harder and harder for my brother to tell me, oh, what he would do a lot of the time after one of these violent events is he would say it was just a game. And you'd been having fun, I'm sure you were, and I don't know why now you're mad, because I could tell you were having such a good time. And so often in my journals, I would see myself revising my memories and saying, well, yeah, I did get hurt, but I think I was having a really good time. And it started very soon after I started my kind of formal education experience, those entries start to change, until there was one kind of violent assault with my brother that happened in a parking lot where I, after the fact, just wrote, this is what happened. I wrote that I'd been terrified. I wrote that I'd been in pain. I wrote that I'd begged him to stop. And while I was writing the entry, my brother knocked on my door, and he came in, and he said to me that what he always said. He said that it had just been a game, that he thought I was having a good time, and that next time, if
How
anything...
How had he hurt you?
He had twisted my arm behind my back, which was something he did quite a lot, until it started to sprain or even to crack a little bit. In that case, it had cracked a bit. And then he was trying to force me out of a car. He wanted me to come into a store with him, and I didn't want to. And that had just, for some reason, made him snap, and he tried to force me out of the car. And it had resulted in this... I had a sprained ankle because he'd grabbed me by my ankle and tried to yank me out of the car. And then after he'd got me out, he twisted my wrist until it had cracked. And so all of this had happened. And then he was trying to tell me that night that it had just been a game, that nothing violent had happened, that we'd just been having fun. And then he left. And it was the first time, I think, that was the first night that I wrote in my journal that I didn't know which version was true. I didn't know which experience. I didn't know what he'd been experiencing. Maybe he had thought it was a game. But I did know what my experience had been, and I had not been having fun. And I think it was probably the first time that my brother attempted to dominate me, and at the end of that process, there were still two minds present, you know, two distinct minds, not just one mind having gained control over the other. So I guess that education in that sense had given me this ability to have my own ideas in the face of other people saying, this is what happened, this is what it means. And ultimately, you know, when I was at Cambridge, I would confront my parents about my brother's behavior, and they would choose not to believe me. In fact, they would try to convince me that I was insane, that I couldn't trust my memories. And what would happen after that was a long period of trying to come to terms with the estrangement that would be a result of that, of their decision, basically. And writing the book for me was at least in part an attempt to come to terms with my own decision, which took me years to make, to let some of those relationships go rather than keep fighting to make them healthy.
What does that mean, letting those relationships go? Are you still in touch with your family?
I email very infrequently with my mother because I found that that's something I can do and still maintain some kind of sanity. There was a period in my life where I couldn't do that. It took me such a long time. You know, the first stage of the estrangement from my parents was not my choice. It was their choice. They told my brother what I'd said about him. And what followed was a long period of threatening, him calling and threatening me, and then eventually he disowned me, and my parents supported that decision. And what followed after that was about 4 or 5 years of me trying to fix those relationships, trying to get them back. And there was a period where my parents offered me a way back into the family. My dad offered a kind of exorcism because he'd been telling people that I was possessed.
An exorcism?
Yeah, or he would give me a blessing and cast out whatever evil spirit he thought had made me say those things about my brother, and I could deny, you know, I could say, I could say that it was the evil spirit that made me say them and kind of go along with it. And then I could have my family back. All I had to do is exchange their memories for mine, their reality for mine, their opinions for mine, and have this blessing. And I could have my family back. And there was a long period where I thought maybe I could do that. I thought maybe that was a deal I could make. And I spent a couple of days, you know, they actually visited me at Harvard. And this is where my father offered me this blessing. He came to Harvard when I was there as a visiting fellow and offered me this blessing. And so we were doing all this sightseeing around Boston, which was just bizarre on its own.
I'm shocked that they left the mountain.
My dad never left. I think it's a testimony to how desperate he was for some kind of resolution, even in his own kind of strange way. And we were going around, and I knew that this blessing had come because he'd explained, he'd been pretty explicit about why he was there. And I spent several days trying to convince myself that it was a deal that I could make, that there would be some dignity in denying my own perceptions of right and wrong, of what had happened, of sanity itself, in order to win the love of my parents. But ultimately, I couldn't do it in the moment. The night before that they were supposed to go back, he offered me this blessing, and I just realized that, you know, the daughter that my father had come to reclaim, she didn't exist anymore. She had read and she'd studied and she'd constructed her own opinions about things in her own mind, and this person that she'd become had no tolerance for violence, and she could not give way to it. And so I told my dad that I loved him very much, but that I couldn't accept the blessing, and he stood and said again that there was an evil presence in my room and that it was better to sleep on a bench than with the devil, and then he left.
And that was it?
That was it. I saw them one more time. I saw my father one more time when I tried to go back one more time after that and try to find another solution, try to put the relationships back together before I accepted that I couldn't. And you know, it's a decision that it's taken me a really long time to come to terms with. I don't know how much longer it will take me to fully come to terms with it. But I think no matter how clear the situation seems from the outside, it's such a difficult decision to make. And I think probably because people feel like they don't have the right to make it. I've always felt like I just don't have the right to walk away from my family. And it took me a long time to realize there are limits to the obligations that you owe to your family. And that sometimes those obligations to your family, they can be in real conflict, real meaningful conflict with what you owe to yourself. And that there are times where you are allowed to choose you. You're allowed to choose yourself.
I have one more question, and that is, how has this entire experience affected your relations with other people in the outside world?
I think when I was going through the, you know, at first when I got to BYU, I was just kind of unusual and I didn't have a lot of social skills. And then I got much better and I had meaningful friendships and I thought that I'd adjusted really well and everything seemed normal. And then when I was going through this process of disownment, I really isolated myself again because I felt like I couldn't communicate with people. There wasn't a way to tell people what was happening to me. Even people who knew a little bit about my background, they just, there wasn't a language to say this is what's happening. And it's kind of one of the reasons that made me want to write the book is a sense that it's so difficult for people to talk about estrangement. And I think because there's so much shame in it, I think the instinct that how could anyone believe I'm a good person if they know that my mother doesn't believe I'm a good person is so strong that I felt like it was impossible for me to talk to people because there just wasn't a language that I could use. So one of the things I wanted to do when I wrote the book was develop that language.
And now?
Now it's much easier to talk to people about it. It got easier when the actual crisis had, you know, once I made the decision to stop seeing my parents and came to terms with that within myself a bit, I found it a lot easier to connect with people. And I was able to kind of move back into those friendships that had been so meaningful to me. The book now is kind of that process squared because it is a level of kind of openness about it that isn't just about telling close friends, right? I mean, I've written a book now and it's out there.
Telling the world.
Yeah, telling everybody.
Tara Westover, congratulations on this extraordinary book and on your unbelievably extraordinary life. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.